We're back. It's the Doomer Optimism podcast. You know that. I'm here with Donald. I don't actually know what he wants to talk about, and he was just gonna tell me what he wanted to talk about, but I said, let's just record and talk about what the pitch is for this episode. I know that we labeled it a podcast about podcasts, and that's all I know. So you take it away, Donald.
All right. So there have been some things weighing on my mind that I thought that you could talk through with me.
Okay.
And the first thing I want to talk about is whether recording these things is a good idea. And so something that's been I've been thinking a lot about. So Georges Bernanos, the French Catholic writer, novelist, said near the end of his life, you don't understand anything about modern civilization unless you understand it, first of all, as a universal conspiracy against internal life. And I've been thinking a lot about how so many people now have ear things in their ears, and they're just listening all the time. Listening all the time to people talking, and some people just put real long hours in that, and there's a kind of cacophony of voices and an absence of silence. This is not a new or original insight, I realize. And so that's the one thing that worries me is that hearing her disembodied voices all the time is making us crazy. And that in recording these things, we're contributing to that. And two, that the presence, the sort of endless selection of interesting conversations in which one is not a participant, just your passive observer, inures us to the absence of actual community and social life. So, not that everyone's a complete shut-in. Some people are now. But relative to our grandparents, pretty much everyone's a shut in at this point. And then even things which we're not passive, like right now I'm leading a reading group through the Catherine Project, which is a really lovely thing, the Catherine Project. And I'm reading over 10 weeks, like about 1,000 pages of fiction by Wendell Berry with a group of people. And it's a really lovely group of people, interesting group of people, from different parts of the country and different vocations. And the discussions are very good. Very good. And I've learned a lot from them. And I think that's why I really wonder if it's a good thing at all, because they are so good.
Wait,
And
walk me
that
through the
having good
logic of that.
discussions with people who are far away through these devices fills some part of our life and then absolves us from having to make that with the people actually around us, that it serves as a kind of I don't know, it's a balm that that is a comfort and a joy in many ways, but perhaps we should not be so comfortable in our situation, that in fact the goodness or the apparent goodness or the it's a sort of shallow goodness that prevents us from, doing the harder thing of, it's much harder to organize a reading group of people in your own town. Read 1,000 pages in 10 weeks, But that's how you actually make real friendships. Not, it's much easier to do it this other way. So that's what's been on my mind. I don't know.
Okay,
Think.
so all of that is good, and I think there's plenty for us to talk about. I think one thing I'll totally agree with you about that has concerned me from the beginning of podcasting is, well, I've always asked, like, does the world need another podcast? What are we doing? Why are we doing this? So we could let, I would like to talk through what is the case for it first. But before we do that, I just want to acknowledge that, like, I do think there is, like, for example, Jason's podcast, Both And, I think it's called Both And, before we started Doomer Optimism, was part of this like network of podcasts that like kind of called itself the Liminal Web. And like there's this sorting into like more and more niche esoteric groups that is completely the antithesis of like being a good neighbor. And by that I mean being normal enough in the sense of relatable enough to have the empathy to find connection with people who are different from you. And I, to me, like, to me, there's a tension there between finding your like weird nerds who share in your niche interests, but not getting sucked into that to the point that you can't lose touch with being able to relate to people different from you. So, okay, let's just talk through like what were we thinking when we started this podcast? Let's talk about like what drew us to it and then I guess like pick apart some of those things. So, when we first started, Jason and I I think there was like a little bit of a one of these niches like that I'm talking about that was kind of unfilled, which was like, I guess people who are like, I get, sort of critical of the more extreme versions of the left, critical of the more extreme versions of the right, critical of mainstream environmentalism, but then doing something practical and kind of like trying to maintain common sense amidst the chaos, the information chaos. And I still think that that is a niche that needs more people in it. Like, just to be a voice of like common sense, some sense of normalcy, reasonableness, the ability to like, not be super extreme. And I do think we also have attempted, whether or not we're successful at it, I'm not sure. To not be too much groupthink and too niche, like too niche to the point that you're like, this is just a homesteading podcast, or this is only about organic farming or whatever else. Like we've been trying to, or it's only like the type of people who believe climate change is the biggest environmental issue get to talk on the podcast or something
So
like that.
two thoughts on that. One, I think that we have what's good in what we do is also the reason that we're not super successful in the terms of
Listeners,
the like views and listeners, etc. That what we've managed, the good thing is that we've managed to create a sort of rallying point out of which real friendships have emerged. Both real friendships in local places, which has happened. It's happened to me. Hi, Mike and Laura, if you're listening to this episode, we should have you over for dinner soon. And also nationally, even internationally. So I think that's good to have a rallying point. And I think it's to my mind, the rallying point is people for whom like ecological issues are real, but who are dissatisfied, who dissatisfied with the environmentalist answer. And also for whom thinking is important, but are unsatisfied with the university, and unsatisfied with, that the sort of available options, like intellectual and ecological, political, are just not satisfying, but who want to try things out. And also not, and like you said, have an attitude of forbearance and neighborliness, which allows for differences. And I think we've managed to do that and maintain that ethos. And I think in maintaining that, it's sort of not pigeonholed, and so it doesn't really work in the attention economy, because that's all about,
Like what's your shtick or
just
whatever?
recording like 1,000 episodes about the same thing. This is like basically what people do. And so I think that's, I wonder. Yeah, so I don't want to sort of toss out those positive things
No, and I'll
that
add
have happened.
one other positive thing, but then I think we can take a turn toward what we're worried about. But just the other day, just this past weekend, I was at this organic farming conference for my day job, and I found some people there who listen to the podcast who are super cool people. This one guy was kind of like an Andy. He looked like him. He kind of acted like him from upstate New
Did he
York.
have the voice?
His name is Jared. He didn't have that same kind of cadence, but like
No one does.
tall,
Andy
skinny
has the
guy
most
with.
beautiful voice on earth.
I
It's
know,
really.
Andy. Oh man. So he's like tall, skinny guy from upstate New York who does draft animals and like cuts wood sustainably and is like and does
Yeah.
regenerative agriculture. Also is neighbors with James Howard Kunstler.
Yeah, of course.
And Kunstler, he never read a Kunstler book, and Kunstler was getting beef from him or something, and he was like, "Jared, have you read any of my books yet?" And he's like, "No." And he finally read one. He was like, "Oh, it's all right."
That's amazing.
And so it
How
was so funny. And so I met them, and I was like,
long has he been farming like that?
I think for as long as he's done it, which I think he's only in his like 30s, so not that long, but he grew up like basically in the woods. And he was like, the first thing he said when I met him was like, "You just like can't be a peasant in America anymore. Like I just want to be like a peasant, do peasant farming." So anyways, this like he was like, "Oh, I heard of Doomer Optimism before." And then his like friend and business partner was like, "Oh yeah, I've been listening to your podcast a ton." And then we got together, and it was me, those two, and Peter Allen, has been on the
I
podcast.
bet they hit it off.
Oh my God, it was great. And then this guy John Eichard, who is like an agricultural economist who's in his like 80s, who basically invented the term sustainable agriculture, like is the first one to publish that term. So I was like, oh my God, John Eichard, I've pub published you in my sociology work. We went to his Airbnb. Sorry to take this detour, but I think it's relevant. And then this other couple of friends who like are connected with like Sarah Day Evans, who's connected with the Berry family, they're Kentucky
Yeah, sure.
farmers. And so we all got together and we just like hung out from like 3 p.m. until 10 p.m. or something, just talking. And basically the gist of the conversation was like, who else do you know whose work makes sense and helps you to make sense of the world? So we're just dropping a bunch of names, but it's not just
Sure.
about like who's in, it's like who is helping you to make sense of the world in what is a very confusing time for a lot of people, with there's a lot of propaganda, a lot of bad information, And a lot of people who are like, yeah, I guess like turning others down a wrong path. And so like kind of like, we're talking about like Glenn Greenwald and Matt Taibbi, and I like some of this stuff, but like I'm skeptical of this other stuff. Like everybody has an agenda. And I said to that group, like, on the one hand, it's like, yeah, maybe it would be better if we just lived in like a little village and all you really were concerned with were like the issues of the village. But because we like live in the world that we live in, we're in this time where information is just really not trustworthy, which is a little scary, but also kind of exciting. And so, like, if anything, I was excited by the prospect of like meeting other thinkers who wrestle with that question seriously and are trying to make sense of the world and keep their wits about them, basically. And this guy, John Eichard, who's like in his 80s, was like, it just all comes down to common sense. Like people know what common sense is, and it's just trying to get hijacked in all these other ways, these various ways we're trying to hijack people's like intuition. And I was like, oh my God, this is so good. I love this conversation. So on the good end, I do feel like we are in like a historical period where that kind of thing is helpful and necessary. Not necessarily necessary. Like people could find each other, even in their own communities, and have these kinds of conversations. But I think like just modeling it on the podcast is has it been inspirational to people of like, what questions to ask even.
So
But then
I
that goes to
couple
your point of like, it's not really about the podcast. It's more about having met these people in person more and more and having these conversations in person.
A couple thoughts. One, long distance internet intellectual friendships are very old fashioned. Nothing wrong with that at all. I mean, we've talked about the Republic of Letters idea. I think that's good, and lots of examples of it in ancient times. So it's just fine, I think. For that to happen, I think part of information being untrustworthy, I think part of the situation is that it's not so much that lots of people are lying, though mendacity is always part of human affairs and has been since that afternoon in the garden. Okay. But that the actual situation is senseless or chaotic, so that it becomes very difficult to describe in a coherent, sensible way. Because the thing being described is unsettled and unsettling. And so I think actually it is not. I think it is a matter of almost want to say survival, or sort of like spiritual survival, not to try to pay attention to like current events and things like that. Like I think like I don't think anyone should read Greenwald or Taibbi. Not because they're like bad. I don't know if they're bad actors or not. I don't know that much about them. But just because they're trying to write about current events and politics. But we shouldn't read anyone for whom that is the main focus. I think it makes people go crazy because it is crazy. The situation is crazy making. Not because the people conveying the information are attempting to make people go crazy. Though some of them are, they found it to be a profitable model, essentially prey on people's like anxiety and confusion and insanity. So I think one of the things that we've done well, and we've been rewarded for it with few viewers is to talk about something different and to talk about our own thing with total disregard for whatever's in the headlines
Yep.
and to have our own trajectory and our own focus that we don't allow to get mixed up with the other stuff.
Yep. And just and to just resist, like we were saying at the beginning, like clear categorization or having a shtick or having a thing where,
Yes.
people expect you to play the hits and you're just saying the same one note. Like I
Or
have a
to
thing about this.
appeal to the to like that one of there's a really pernicious thing now where like people are forced to give apologies to the general public,
Oh,
you know,
right.
to speak, you know, it's to be held. Anyway, it's a terrible thing, but I think a lot of things, not just apologies, are addressed to that, you know, abstraction
Yep.
of the public, and it causes a deformation of rhetoric.
So I have two kind of unrelated thoughts. The first one is two summers ago, I think it was. I don't even think it was last summer. I think it was 2 summers ago. People were asking, or Jason and I came up with this idea. I don't even know who came up with the idea of like doomer optimism camps. And a bunch of people got together, and I think the rallying cry thing is important, like being just a beacon. Where it was really weird to be sitting in Uruguay, not in the US that summer, and just telling people, inviting people to organize their own camps, and then it happening was really weird, a weird experience for me, because it was like, we've made a point of like where people see themselves reflected or are drawn to this thing, and all you have to do is really invite them in. And that's a really cool thing to be like, people just intuitively are interested in it and trusting enough to like want to go out of their comfort zone and meet other people. So that was cool. And I was talking to Peter Allen about that, and he was like, we should do more. We should do it again this summer. And like, yeah, I think people just want to be invited, and that's a cool thing. Another unrelated point that I wanted to come back to before, when you were talking at the beginning, is there's this, have you ever seen the Woody Allen movie, Vicky Cristina Barcelona?
I have actually.
Okay, so there's this tortured artist character, Javier Bardem. His dad is like this Spanish poet who, only speaks Spanish, and he's a poet, but he doesn't write down any of his poetry ever, because that's like a way that it gets like corrupted and captured, and it should only be like said in the place and time where the poetry like is in his soul. And I like, to me, that's the underlying argument here. Like, once you're recording these things, how are people using them? How is it abstracting all of the good ideas or all of the like good intuitive forces of, wanting to be reasonable and wanting to like model reasonableness and think things through, model thinking things through out loud, and like being messy or unsure, or you're evolving your thinking, being neighborly, and empathetic. But then, yeah, like you were saying at the beginning, how much of that then is kind of enabling more of the same like isolation, with people, intellectual isolation, just n no peace and quiet. Like, how many people are listening to podcasts? There's this scene in Portlandia where they're like, did you read that? Did you read that? Did you listen to that? Did you do that? And it's like, have you read this new article? Did you read? And it's like, there is this endless sense of like, you could just fill your whole days just like keeping up with the discussion. And that's something I don't want to enable, really, despite putting out like two podcasts a week for the past 2 years. And so I've been thinking a lot about this, like, maybe this podcast just gets transformed into real relationships, and it was a period in time that existed partially because of the pandemic, and a lot of people were isolated at home, and that's fine to give people like a little voice during that isolated period, but to not keep enabling that indefinitely.
And it's transformed how space. So I flew to down to California to see my brother recently. And my town has a very small airport. I think there are four gates at the airport. Oh, it's nice. You can show up, half an hour before
Yeah.
and leaves kind of deal. But I was sitting at the gate, and I got to chatting with two ladies there, and one of them was flying down to she's gonna fly down and then drive 2 hours to surprise her daughter on for her daughter's birthday. Because
Okay.
her daughter had moved out recently and was living in a trailer and didn't think anyone was gonna be there to celebrate her birthday, and so the mom was like, God put it in my heart. I need to go and see my daughter and be there on her birthday, which is a beautiful thing. And so we just, we were chatting and talking about, stuff in our county, and it was very nice. But that can't happen if everyone has the little
I know.
things in their ears. And then we were on the same flight coming back, so I got to chat with her again, about how it went,
Yeah.
and her daughter was crying, and it was very, and they had a nice weekend together. So, we're slowly displacing even the small interactions and conversations with sort of disembodied voices.
Yeah.
Never mind the absence of silence. I've been privately printing books, like out of print books. So I printed a private printing of Max Picard's The World of Silence.
Mm
It was a fascinating book. It's about silence, but really highlighting the disappearance of silence from,
mm.
and how silence is its own world. Anyways, it's not an absence. It's a something strong. But putting aside podcasts, I mean, road car noise and the low hum of electricity, airplanes, and so on. We've been working hard to get rid of silence for a while now. And I don't know that at this point, I don't think we even understand what we're missing.
No, I know. I know. And you worry about like this, what I mean, it's like, I don't know, calling it the boiling frog phenomenon, but it is real. It's like, people don't even know what they don't know and have never even experienced some of these things to the point that you're talking to somebody who's like, sometimes you're making an argument with somebody who's like just never even had this experience of like silence or never having an experience of not having like the latest gadgets in their ears all the time. I remember I babysat these kids in Hyde Park, and the son just, he was a teenager. He just would have earbuds in or headphones in all the time. And like his peers were kept getting ear infections. Like it was a common thing among his peers to get ear infections as like
Teenagers.
young teens because of the headphones. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, totally. I mean, yeah. So I worry about that stuff all the time, the advance of tech and like how normalized it's become. I mean, if
And we're
anything,
doing it to ourselves. I think that's the important thing. There's not sort of shadowy actors doing this to us. Certainly, there are companies marketing all these things and trying to profit on them. But ultimately, we're doing it to ourselves. And I don't think that we can, I don't think we, it makes I don't think we can blame anyone else. That it's all there is nothing. Okay. Highway noise, electrical hum, airplanes, that's a little harder to get away from.
Yeah.
Possible, harder to get away from. You can get away from it at least in, I don't know, there's some places you can go. Like I could drive up to Northern British Columbia and
Yeah.
there's really not nobody up there. So it is possible. But you know, for the most part, we're making these choices ourselves. I think that there I interviewed James Poulos the other day. And he wrote something recently about resisting cyborg fatalism. The way people talk, it's as if this thing's just, you know, it's
Just
gonna
come at
happen and
you.
there's nothing
Yeah.
you can do about it. Well, in your own life, there's plenty you can do. You can choose not to do these things.
Yep.
You can choose when given the choice between a person and a machine, you can choose the person.
Yeah. Well, okay, so here's like a practical question on how to use our agency as like a group of people who kind of found each other on the internet and built friendships and also enabled other friendships. So we talked about the good side of it, but then like the other side of me wants to be like, okay, that's done now. If you want to go find other people, like go do it. And there's nothing stopping you, and you just need to like, you need to just be more of a an agentic actor on the world, and go find people like, and it's not that hard. Just, you know, you have to just make an effort. You have to talk to a lot of people. You have to put a lot of your like interests out into the universe and find your other people. But then, yeah, I don't know, because like, you know, when doomer optimism first started, we were kind of all hanging out on Twitter. We had this presence, but then more and more people are like less interested in public debate on the Twitter timeline, and now people have just become friends and are just like texting each other on their phones or writing each other letters or meeting in person. Like I almost never talk to Peter Allen, but I've hung out with him twice for long weekends in the past, you know, whatever, 6 months, and we're that what a great friendship. We like we don't talk basically digitally at all, and we just when we talk we get to you know talk a lot and at length and debate things and talk in great depth, and I yeah part of me feels like allowing the podcast to transform into this isn't just shouldn't just be navel gazing about this podcast because I think in general you're right like I think people need to just realize that podcasts are. Like the cy what did Poulos call it? The
Cyborg fatalism.
cyborg fatalism. And people also like, yeah, we are contributing to that. You know, it is the machine to have those earbuds in
So
all the time.
here's something I'll ask of our dozen listeners. I'm really okay. So I think this is an open question for me somewhat. If I thought that doing this was just bad, full stop, I wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
Okay. So is there some value in occasionally, in a public way, thinking and reflecting on something like this and the dangers of it? And the positive possibilities of it too. And does that outweigh the risks?
Yeah.
Or is every additional second of digital video and audio just another just digging ourselves a little bit deeper in a hole.
Is it a universal conspiracy against internal life?
Yes. And Poulos and I disagreed with each other fair, it's like we agreed a lot on the sort of troubles of our general situation, but disagreed on
What to do about it?
what to do about it. Though I'll admit that I don't totally understand his proposal for what to do about it. It's hard to say I disagree with something because I don't fully understand it.
Right.
But I mean, there's that those families in Maryland, who did the Postman Pledge. Have you heard about this?
No.
So there's some articles about it in Front Porch Republic, but some families in Maryland whose kids are getting older, and they're like, okay, we don't want our kids being coming screen kids. And so we're going to get together as families and make a pledge where, we're going to limit that kind of thing. And but even more importantly than just highlighting tech criticism is we're going to do things together
To fill
that's
that time.
to fill that time and to give our especially teenagers like
A rich social life.
a rich social life so that they're not just being, not just having something taken away from them.
Yeah,
I'll
or
say
isolation.
parenthetically that I think smartphones and teenagers, it's somewhat akin to like all the teenagers are doing meth. And so my kid's left out because he doesn't get to
Do
do
math.
drugs with
Yeah.
everybody else. Well, it's like, okay, even if you can't provide rich social life, you still don't give your kid
Yeah,
meth. Because,
yeah.
okay, so like, but that
Yeah.
aside, so they're doing, like, I don't know, it's lovely stuff. Dancing and singing and having a good time. It's not sort of aesthetic self-denial. Those aesthetic self-denial is very good. In this case, it's building a rich social life in community. And so I think ultimately that sort of thing is more valuable than just tech criticism, of which there has been a lot.
Yep.
Like over, so we have all of the sort of mid-century tech critics, Shaka Leul and Marshall McLuhan and Ivan Illich, and all of them have sort of regained new readers now because it turned out they were right about everything, or things were even worse than they thought.
But who's
But it
even, but
didn't
who's doing
matter.
anything about it? Who's
Yes,
doing,
it didn't
who's
matter. Like all that
providing?
tech criticism,
Yeah.
it can be acceded to 100%, and then what? So, yeah, I mean, I
It's the
think.
doomer, it's the doomer side of the podcast, which we're not satisfied to leave. And I think a lot of podcasts do will gain a lot of viewers and have, like, I think about this Nate Hagen's podcast. It's just doomerism. It's just rehashing how bad things are with different numbers and different people's philosophies. Like, and to me, I couldn't imagine something more boring or self-defeating. And if in my greatest fantasies, we this small subset of people and other people who are doing it already without our help are imagining and enacting alternatives to that, to the problems that we're faced with. This is the whole premise of it, and sharing that to the point that it then becomes contagious in a positive way. And yeah, I mean, in my greatest fantasy, there's a robust enough way to find one another and way to get information about what's out there, and that, and there's a group of people who get like, who enact their agency and aren't just passive consumers of good ideas, but instead are like out there doing stuff. Like my mission right now, my little agency, I've got my little permaculture garden that I'm be working on in my tiny yard in Chicago. And then the other thing I've been working on is like my kids are going to Chicago public schools, and there's some bad stuff going on in these schools, and there's 300,000 kids enrolled in Chicago public schools, and I'm like, I got to be engaged with this institution if I'm going to be sending my kids there. I could just homeschool, but I'm going to try this out. And I could go on and on about like Chicago public schools are so horrible, but I went there and I found a lot of value in going to public school and forming who I was, who I am, like just being around different kids, people who are different from me in my whole upbringing, in my young, my youth. Was extremely formative to me in a way that I think is really cool. Like public school can be a force for real pluralism and tolerance. But it's totally being hijacked by really messed up actors. And so yeah, just like I like talking about that, even though it's a little bit risky, socially risky to do. Like I like talking about what do you do about these problems? And I just think like if in our greatest fantasy, in our greatest success, we should be doing that, somehow transmitting that information to like rally other people to pay attention, to get involved, to use their agency to like enact real alternatives and not just be like passive victims to all the problems of the modern era.
So Illich talked about the askesis of attention. And he, I think, refused to use amplification of his voice.
Okay.
That it was important for him if he was talking somewhere that his voice not be amplified, that
Okay.
that was dehumanizing and some that he has a lovely essay about like what defined a parish was the distance from which the bells are still audible.
Oh, I love that.
And that defines the community of a parish, the distance to which the bells are still audible. And this is, of course, before we have road noise and plane noise and so on. And so it was easier for to hear bells, I guess. And I mean practical things, I think, it's easy to come up with sort of personal rules. And those are good. At least I myself love rules. For myself. But I think the Postman Pledge families are more powerful because they're not it they're having a positive they're living out a positive vision of social life together. So I've been leading this Wendell Berry group, and every week I've been giving people challenges or little tasks to do. I started doing this. So, like, tell a story. You have to tell someone a story. Because in Wendell Berry's fiction, everyone's telling stories all the time. And they tell the same stories all the time. And that's how the community knows itself. That everyone know, and so that by the time, the stories go way back too. So that everyone they become part of you, and the past is integrated into the present. So the community's constantly talking about itself, and so I had everyone tell stories, either by themselves or just retell one of the Wendell Berry stories. I've been telling my daughters these stories, but the Wendell Berry stories, some of which are really funny. The stories of Ptolemy Proudfoot are really funny. Burley Coulter, all these are great characters. And my daughters love it. And I was like, oh, do you have a new Wendell Berry story to tell me?
Oh, I
Not to
love
read it aloud, but to retell it. And it's a Charlotte Mason thing, too, to be able to
that.
retell it, to narrate a story. That's how you really know it. And so then I had everyone talk to a neighbor, one of their neighbors. And preferably ask their neighbor for help. The real way to get to know somebody, right? Either help them or to ask them to help you to do something together. And so that was interesting to hear how that went, and my latest one is to have everyone write a letter. And those are just small things, but I don't know. I think we're in such a sorry state. We gotta build ourselves up slowly.
Yep, definitely. Yeah, I was thinking when you were talking about these different rules, like I think the main thing that I want to be super intentional about on this podcast, but better in my life, like it is really easy to get sucked into some kind of, it's easy to, a lot of people do this. It's easy to give your kid, your teenager, a smartphone. All the other kids have it. Like, it's much harder to be intentional. It's easier to get sucked into like content creation. Like all these people on Twitter, like, they're just not just Twitter, but like the new media. And I think people are trying to make sense of the world, and that's like the charitable reading. But then there is like totally just a, you're a talking head who has a point of view, and like, people are just this like, there's something really gross about it, like just being this talking head that's like disembodied from any place or time. And you're like, oh yeah, you're the homesteader girl or whatever, even though I'm like, I my whole point was that like homesteading should never be like this esoteric, weird niche thing, but everybody turns it into these little identities. So yeah, like,
You gotta
just
make a living. I mean, that's the hard, I think a lot of people are, trying to escape 9 to 5, and I'm sure in many ways the content creation grind is a lot more pleasant than working some other job. And
But
sometimes it's kind of, I like grass music. There's all sort of family bands who are able to make a living
yeah.
just recording themselves, like playing bluegrass music on their porch or whatever. And they're no longer having, like, opening your private family life to outside viewers. It's like the mom blog problem. Very dangerous.
Yeah, it's super
If there's
dangerous.
no separation, then your private life becomes public, and a lot of danger there, but playing music, it's hard to make a living as a musician. Very hard to make a living as a musician. Very hard to make a living as a writer. Always has been. So I'm sympathetic
But
with
the but
people
it's
who
just
try to with people who try to do that,
but
but
then
there's dangers.
it's all in my mind on this slippery slope spectrum between this like character in Vicky Cristina Barcelona who just won't even write anything down to like someone who's totally in the machine and is just, caught up with their audience and having a platform and, caught in the grind of that and like totally just monetizing every aspect of their private thoughts or private life.
I think it's more than just a slippery slope. I think it's a well-greased hill.
It is. And it takes a lot of effort to not pigeonhole yourself or try to monetize or get audience captured. But like, yeah, I mean, I still think it's an ongoing question mark whether or not the abstract or the theoretical person, listener, I might be helpful to versus like my real neighbors. I don't know. Like, I'm just getting more and more convinced that maybe, disembodied conversations, like we've covered a lot of ground. Go back and watch the old podcasts or whatever if you want
But
inspiration.
neighbors aren't intellectual friends.
No,
There's,
I
I think, the
know.
difference. I think it's actually to not, I think, like, one of the that neighborliness that is also understanding the limits, not demanding
Too
too
much.
much, or expecting to, not demanding that neighbors conform to your vision, but taking them as they are. And
But I also wonder, whether or not, why do I need an audience for my relationships with my new intellectual friends?
Yeah.
Do I really? I mean, are we adding anything? And I'm increasingly just like
Yeah.
intuitively feeling that the project has developed something really cool. It had a really interesting run, especially for a period, but increasingly just like I'm having a lot of independent conversations with people I've met on this podcast and relationships with them, like intellectual relationships, friendships. You know, this past weekend was a testament to that. It was like, my gosh, this is the coolest thing that this conversation is happening, and the things people were saying in it. It doesn't need to be recorded. Not everything is content, you know, or not everything should be in front of an audience. And there's something really valuable in those private conversations, in not having an audience and not recording everything.
I think that's right. I also wonder, maybe coming back around arguing with myself, I wonder if we quit doing these things, whether the other things would atrophy a little bit. And then,
Well, that's the question. Yeah.
in a weird way, we need to have some danger that doing these things is dangerous, and that little bit of danger, you know. It's always dangerous to say, to think in public, like
Yeah.
there's a conflict between philosophy and the city. You the paradigmatic figure, of course, is Socrates, who was killed, but you know, it, that persists to the extent that philosophy exists anymore. I'm not sure it does. But at least the possibility of it does. So, but you know, I guess the well, I didn't think this is the direction this was going to go. But the Socratic turn, and he talked, this is, you can read about this in Plato's Phaedo, is that Socrates initially was just wanting to think about natural philosophy. But then, his turn, his second sailing, is then he goes into the city and starts having conversations, comparing speeches, and he's not just sort of meditating on natural philosophy, but he seeks out interlocutors in public. You know, they're having con they're, Plato records private conversations too, like Symposium is a private conversation. Very strange dialogue for a variety of reasons. Maybe we could talk about that another time. But yeah, the philosophy somehow, there's a tension or conflict between philosophy and the city, but it's not a total conflict, that the one needs the other. That you have to find people to talk with.
And I think there is something to be honest, quite selfish about thinking, you know, this is only for me. It's, you know, and I think there the major thing though that I want to push back against is every thought you have is a public spectacle. Every piece of content you want to put out is to be monetized or should get the biggest possible audience you can get. But instead, like, I wonder whether or not, and I, you know, we've been playing with this idea, you know, amongst all of us, of like different layers of public and private, depending on, you know, your goals. But, you know, some relationship, some meetups, some conversations are private and necessarily so. But then maybe these intermediary events where there's like a little bit of public, a little bit of private. Some people are invited who are kind of unknown, but there's like a, you know, a trust being built amongst this intellectual network. Like, to me, I really want to fight against the totalizing force of like get as many eyeballs on as possible, make every single thing a public thing. But I do think you're right. Like, there is a total value, and now we're arguing with ourselves to build it, building in public and wrestling in public, like wrestling sincerely with ideas, not like, silly play the hits content creation, but genuinely wrestling publicly.
But well, we've succeeded in not having a big audience, so we can check that box. And I think at this point, our dozen listeners were probably down to about three. So hello to all three of you.
We keep getting more subscribers on YouTube, but I don't know. But I do think that I've met some Doomer Optimism listeners in the wild, not many, like three ever, and they're always the most interesting people. And to me, like, if we're we have very high quality listeners, and if those listeners then genuinely make other intellectual friends and local friends and are like getting together, the impact could be really significant, even if even in a tiny group.
I like to think that we are providing exit ramps from bad feedback loops of exit ramps and feedback loops. How's that for a mixed metaphor?
But also,
These bad loops of thinking that people can get into, and there's a lot of them on offer now. And they're kind of they're sort of package deals, you know. You can, and then you sort of get, you can become part of a little circle of people on the internet, and there's usually at the center of it someone who's making a living, pushing the idea. And I think the extent that we've really remained amateurs at this is a good thing.
But also exit ramp from podcast listening. Like, this should be a podcast that gets
Yes.
you stop listening to podcasts.
Like, did you listen to the Hobo Nichols interview?
No.
Yeah, so she's her husband is in seminary. He might be a priest now, but she writes a zine called Hobo Nichols and did a issue of it about silence, and so we talked about that. But I think by the end of it, we're like, okay, if you're somehow still listening to this, you know, just like throw your phone into the ocean. I really didn't expect this at all. But the more we talk about this, the more like Plato really looms large to me. Just like the distinction between a sophist and a philosopher, which is not a simple distinction at all. Jacob Klein wrote the very dry, especially in the beginning, but powerful book on the history of mathematics. But he has the origin of algebra. But he has something in there about Plato that I think about often. It's like page 83 or 84, somewhere around there. About how the sophists in Plato are a dramatic representation of something true about being, namely that the mirror ability of being, that representation is possible. So the sophists aren't bad guys in Plato. Socrates argues with them, but that, and reveals them in as false in some way. But and Plato's such a subtle writer that in his description of them, that they end up like dramatically acting out something true. That's far afield from where we started. So anyway, I welcome conversation about this. This is something, in the Wendell Berry group, I brought this up at the end of our last meeting. It's like, is what we're doing here good? And I felt bad because everyone was like, "Oh, I love this group," and I felt like I was fishing for compliments, and then I feel I had to like,
No, it's good, Donald. You're so good.
I had to just, yeah, I was like, "Oh, this is a wonderful class,
No, but I
this is
think
so."
it's I
But it's
part
like, yes, that's the trouble. It's like the fact I don't disagree that it's wonderful, but that it actually is like in the same way that, like, I don't have a smartphone, but because they're marvelous, they're sort of so good. And I'm using good not as a moral term here, but they're so enticing, maybe is the better
Yeah.
word, and well done. It's
And
like
there's a lot that you can do with them.
so many people are really good at making things interesting. We have like we live in a world of like the action movie genre, as like we have John Wick, we have like all these things, like they're sort of perfectly designed to be captivating. And that's why they're actually dangerous. If
Yeah, I mean,
the things were just like obviously pernicious and disgusting and horrible, well, there wouldn't really be a problem because, we would just not do it. We would just turn away from it. But obviously that we have trouble turning away from it because that's not the case.
And there are obvious drawbacks, but obvious, positive qualities. I mean, so when I did I organized this homesteading 101 class, and it was like, I picked some people to talk on different topics who I thought were like, interesting thinkers, but I didn't have it in my mind. I want the best thinker on every topic. I just thought it's worthwhile to have these like people and have their different perspectives and for things to be like messy and amateurish. And I think the drive to make things like super polished is also a drive to make things the most lizard-brained possible, in the sense of like this it requires no critical thought, critical engagement, reaction. When things are informal and less polished, you're having to have a reaction to what the person is saying, and then you can push back against it, and then that strengthens your ability to think about what you think and what information is coming at you. And I just feel like everything is just so smooth now, like there's no friction. And if anything, like being thoughtful about engaging with the amateur messiness, and yeah, like informality of it all is kind of an act of resistance in this world where things just get more and more professional. And by professional, it's like market tested, lizard brain, where like, okay, well, this is an unassailable thing to say, and or will rile someone up in like the most least common denominator way.
And I think it's interesting how people don't seem strangely uninformed about that. So, for example, there's all of these stupid cycles of where something you'll just notice like everyone writes about the same thing.
Yeah, news cycle or whatever.
Okay. So, like, someone asked recently, like, why do all these right-wing guys, why are they all writing about Taylor Swift? I said, because that is their business to write about whatever thing. And if lots of people are saying X, then there's a marketplace for saying Y, whatever the dumb thing is. No one actually cares.
No.
None of these people care at
And
all.
it's just bait. Like, it's just
They
bait.
have, I'm sure, and a lot of the ones who are more professional have like an SEO manager who was like, here are the 10 things you need to talk about this week. And you need to take this position on each of them because it will, if you do, we'll get
So,
XYZ. There's a crude arithmetic to digital marketing.
yeah.
And there's no way that you can do that intelligently
No, although I just have to
well.
say, when
You
you're
have to
talking,
walk away.
This there's this guy who I really like. He's a writer named Oliver Bateman. Have you followed him at all?
The name's vaguely familiar, but
Yeah,
no.
so basically like
And Oliver, if we've had a long storied correspondence that I've forgotten, I apologize. I don't think we have.
he's really funny because he literally just tweets things like what the formula is. So X culture thing, what everyone is saying in a certain group is Y. Make sure you say Z, but then the next week you can just argue back Y again. And it's just enough to like, and he calls it doing the work. So he says, like, Oliver Bateman does the work, and he just totally knows that there's a formula. He writes like, you know, the first time I came across him is like making fun of the dissident right and BAP, you know, because of their take on Christianity. And it's like, it doesn't matter. It just X, Y, and Z, just copy and paste them out. I think he's very smart, but he's just like, this is just a business.
But the
It's just a,
cynicism of that, I think, would be just
I know, I know,
to
I'm,
you as an actor.
yeah.
I mean, it's funny, I guess, for a little while, but at some point it's like, what are you doing with your
Yeah,
life?
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't want to like deny a man a profession. You gotta
Right. Well, and that's the thing.
put
Like,
food on the, you gotta put
it's
food on
just
the table. I mean, the
a
funnier thing that people do is to intentionally say wrong, get things wrong about topics for which people are really devoted. To like say wrong things about guns or about cars or whatever, you know, and then people jump in to get mad and correct you. It's a very cynical game.
It's all very cynical though, yeah.
And
And
it's
fundamentally,
funny, I guess it's funny in a way. I don't know.
well, and I mean, I guess like the idea is that you're kind of subverting people's impulses to weigh in, and you know that you're kind of just like, you know, puppeteering the masses. But you know, at a certain point, what are you adding to the world? It's just more noise. And
I don't
so,
think it subverts anything, though. I think we're beyond the point of parody. I don't think parody.
is
I
even
don't think you
helpful.
can. I don't. Yeah, I don't think that parody works anymore beyond it. And also, I don't think. I mean, like we went in the 90s. There was like the new sincerity literary. You know that the criticism of cynicism is very old. That irony and cynicism. I mean,
I
that's
mean, I do have to admit, I think Oliver's super smart, but I am just predisposed towards sincerity and get very bored by cynicism. I get very bored also by everybody having the same opinion on something. It's like, okay, this is not, you know, if we're not even just having a space where there's a place for discussion, a place for evolution, for change in your thinking or refining your thinking. That's very
of
boring
course,
to
the
me.
contrarian is also now a set character with a set of lines. So, where what to do now? I don't know. I mean, I'm of two minds about it. I think, yeah, I wonder at the. I really do wonder at whether it's a good idea to do these things, as I said. And I'm curious, you know, for the last listener who's still listening, to let us know, you know. You can write to, I guess I'm harder to track down
but you can write
than
to me.
Ashley is, but just write to Ashley and she'll share whatever, you know. It's only one of you, so we're not going to be inundated here. So just you,
Just comment on the video. Almost no one comments on any of our.
Yeah, don't do that. Well, actually, here's maybe then we can close up.
Because it would be public then.
Have you noticed that YouTube comments are often the most sort of sincere and wholesome place on the
I have
internet,
noticed
where
that.
there'll be like people like posting, like a live recording of a bluegrass band, and people will just be laying their hearts out, being like, oh, my wife's in the hospital, and this song just really touched my heart, and thank God for making this beautiful music. And then people will be replying and praying for the guy's wife, and this is pretty common, actually. So if you have something nice like that to write, if we've touched your heart in some way, that would be a real comfort for me, at least, to know that if you want to share your thinking, though, maybe just leave like wholesome, heartfelt things in the comments. And if you want to share your thinking, then track down Ashley and write to her, and she can share your writing with me, and we can talk about it. So I don't know. I mean, the program's really the same, isn't it? Try to grow some food and have some babies and raise them right and read some books, talk to your neighbors, go to church, yeah, that's the same. It's not as
same old program.
It's simple. It's not easy. It's simple. It's not easy. We're not all called to be farmers, but I'm sure not. But we can try to buy stuff from the people who are. And
And keep your, I mean, part of the message of the podcast is keep your wits about you. Like, just keep your wits about you. Just try not to get hijacked in one thing or another that's meant to be a conspiracy against your internal life.
Yeah, maintain your yeah, guard your heart, and I was telling someone yesterday, I was like, I don't know. I was like, I don't think Christians should own smartphones. And she was like, come on, I thought that was unreasonable. I was like, okay, well, if you do, then you better, you really got to put on a shield. You got to have, if you this was something Poulos talked about, that we can't just leave these digital tools to people who hate us, but that people actually have to develop the discipline spiritually to be able to wield them defensively. I don't know what that means. I can't figure out what that actually means in practice, to wield these tools defensively. In my mind, it's much better just to not do them.
But this video is a tool that you're wielding defensively. We're not letting it, we're not turning
Maybe.
on a webcam and, becoming OnlyFans influencers or whatever, XYZ. We're using this tool in a way with discernment.
I hope so.
At least we hope. And
I
I do
think,
think.
so I wonder if someone 100 years from now, 100 years ago, would just be like, all of you are lunatics.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Even the most discerning, like,
Or like
oh, I'm being
supposedly, yeah.
thoughtful and careful, be like, you are a crazed shut-in who, is the worst neighbor ever and doesn't know how to dance,
Well, okay, so I
and
do
are
think,
lazy and can't, anyway. So again, I think we've really inured ourselves to a lot. We've really become a nerd to a lot of degradation.
totally. I mean, just yesterday I was interviewing for my day job a farmer who's from Kenya and came to the US like 20 years ago, but goes back to Kenya every year. And I was asking him how he learned how to farm, and he said, like growing up, my mom farmed and we had like vegetables and we had livestock. And we talked about like how he maintains soil health. And he was like, back in Africa, like you would just have the animals on the land and that would help with the soil fertility. And it was just so rich. And I remember like you never had to add anything to the soil. It's like, yeah, because you had this holistic system. And it's just so pathetic now that we have to like have conversations with soil scientists about how to integrate livestock into our systems to like prove that it's holistic and that it's good for nutrient management. It's just like we're so far gone on certain things. And it's like this guy just, basically like small scale subsistence agriculture in Africa Everybody understands that. And then he
Well, I
comes
mean, there's been
here.
troubles there too, a lot of deforestation
Yeah, but I mean,
and topsoil loss. But I hear you. I keep saying the one final thing too. So a friend of mine in Southern Indiana, he used to always say that the apocalypse already happened there. Like there's no topsoil, it already happened. And there's no, we don't have to wait for the calamity. It happened already. Just through the genius of petroleum fertilizers, we can just grow corn and soybeans anyway. But the apocalypse already happened. And I think that intellectually, spiritually, the same thing. We were talking about this the other day. You, me, and what's the fellow? We had a conversation about this. But I think like the calamity, we don't have to wait
Josh.
future. Yeah, Josh, we don't have to wait for a future calamity. It's already happened. Okay, so now we have to figure out what to do. And
And I
then
think like
finally, I can't resist a book recommendation. But Jean Giono's, you know, his lovely little story novella, "The Man Who Planted Trees."
No.
It's great. I think Chelsea Green publishes it, and it's just a simple story, fictional story, about a guy who's hiking. Where in the Pyrenees, maybe? Anyway, Giono's a French writer, and he comes across an old guy who has just devoted his life to planting oak trees. And he doesn't have like a anyone giving him permission to do it, or he doesn't have a scientific plan. He just has a stake, you know, and he puts a little hole and he puts the acorn in, covers it, and goes. And he's just planting thousands and thousands of trees, you know, and he transforms a landscape that had become kind of dead and barren. And then suddenly, you know, the soil is root bound, and you know, the streams are filled with water again. And so, you know, it's a really like beautiful, beautiful story. But the funny thing is, in the afterword, there's some guy from a nonprofit that's all about planting trees. And I'm sure it was well-meaning and the guy's nice, but his whole thing is like, you know, if this story inspires you, like contact such and such organization and, you know, like learn how to do blah, blah, blah. Which seemed to me the exact opposite of the whole
Ethos.
thing of the story, which is just this old guy doesn't contact any organization or ask
He just does
permission.
it.
He just does it, and then in doing it, you know, I'm sure discovered things about what works and what didn't. So I don't know how we got there,
No,
but
I don't know
I
either,
think
but
that seems like a good place to end. So thank you, to the one person still listening to this, and I look forward to hearing from you, because I think you're obligated at this point, to write to us and tell us what you think.
Well, thanks for having this conversation, Donald. I think it's part of how one resists the machine is to be somewhat self-reflective at intervals and to make sure you're not getting sucked in beyond your own desires. So I'm glad we talked about this.
Thank you.
Okay.